Ballots from county to county have a wide range of local choices to be decided Tuesday on Election Day. On Inside, I'll check in with reporters in Reno, Placer County, and Nevada County. We'll talk about some of the key issues there. Then Stockton Record columnist Michael Fitzgerald. He wrote the last of his more than 4,200 columns last week. We'll talk about why he decided to retire and how San Joaquin County has changed over the 30-plus years of his career. Courtney Hameister is here today. She was the longtime head writer and host of Livewire Radio. She's written a new book about her life as, well, she calls herself a professional nervous person. We'll talk about that. And Jeff Hudson previews upcoming classical concerts. That's in this week's Sound Advice. I'm Beth Ruyak. It's all ahead on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. What motivates you to vote? And is this election different to you for some reason? Besides the statewide races, there are many local campaigns and ballot measures that vary across California and Nevada. We're going to check in to some election news across the region with Pascal Fussholer from Nevada County and Gus Thompson from Placer County. But let's start with state politics reporter James DeHaven from the Reno Gazette Journal, and we'll talk about the Reno-Nevada area. Hi, James. Glad to have you on Insight.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So early voting is giving everyone a bit of an indicator. Tell me about the picture in Reno.
So the picture statewide is that Democrats are up by about 2 percentage points. In Washoe County and in Reno, they're looking roughly the same. They're up by a little bit, more than you expect, I suppose, for a technically Republican-leaning county. But we haven't seen a blue wave emerge either here or statewide, which is kind of surprising given a lot of the hype that was surrounding, you know, maybe the anti-Trump voter sentiment that was expected and the blue wave we've heard about in special elections around the country. So at least so far, we haven't seen signs of that, and we have 2 days of early voting left.
But Nevada's reputation and pathway of voting in more recent elections has been the color purple. So
yeah.
Overall, what are you looking at after next Tuesday?
It's hard to say. We have a very close race for U.S. Senate where Dean Heller is considered the most vulnerable Republican senator up for re-election. And we have a perhaps arguably even closer race for governor where Attorney General Adam Laxalt is facing Clark County Commissioner Steve Sisolak, who holds a lot of Democratic votes down in southern Nevada. So both of those contests are going to be very tight, and I'm not sure that early voting at this point tells us much about which way they're leaning.
But early voting has been strong. Tell me about some of those local issues. Washoe County always is proud of its intense political voice. What's going on around the more local region?
Well, what matters to Washoe voters is affordable housing and, in many cases, the environment, as far as flooding and building in floodplains, things of that nature. And it's interesting because those type of issues, and affordable housing included, haven't really factored into the broader races, but they do. You know, they are going to have an impact in you know, mayor's races, assembly races, Washoe County Commission races, and we have tons of those on the ballot. Shoot, we even have an assessor's race that has been very contentious this year. So it's just a good year for voters to be well-informed, I'll put it that way.
A visit by Vice President Mike Pence is making headlines. Tell me about that news.
I didn't go to the Pence rally on Saturday. I know that he said something to the effect of the Democrats' blue wave is going to crash against a red wall here in Nevada. And again, just judging by the early voting numbers, I don't see a red wall or a blue wave. So, but these are the type of things that you tell your voter base when you go to these rallies because you're trying to get them to go to the polls, right? So you want to fire them up. You want to encourage them and, you know, not make them feel or suspect that you know, staying home is a better alternative.
In some areas of California, James, how people vote has changed because of a state law that was passed. There are vote centers. Everybody's getting a vote by mail ballot. There are just some other changes that are in the process, in transition for California voters. what's either happening that's different or being discussed leading up to 2020 in Nevada?
Not a lot. I mean, there is a ballot measure this time around that would allow people, or actually make people, automatically registered to vote when they go to the DMV to, like, renew their license or get a driver's license or whatever. So that's a step that advocates are really happy to introduce, and it'll probably pass, judging by what I've heard. But we have a system currently, and, you know, perhaps it hasn't been terribly well advertised, but where you can vote at any voting center. You don't necessarily have to go to your precinct. So those type of things are already in place here.
All right. I want to keep you on standby till next Tuesday, or actually till next Wednesday morning. How about that?
Yeah, that's fine. I'll be on standby in pretty much every aspect of my life.
So. I was just going to say, if you didn't make a joke about it, I was going to. So, yeah. All right, James, thanks a lot. Glad to have you on our program.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's political reporter James DeHaven with the Reno Gazette Journal. Let's skip over to Nevada County. On the phone is Pascal Fussholer, co-editor of the online news source Ubinet. Hi, Pascal. It's been a while, but tell me about the election ramp up in Nevada County.
Well, good morning, Beth. Yeah, well, Nevada County's 69,000 voters are part of the Voters Choice Act. So, counties in California, of course, have the part of the pilot program. So it's Madera, Napa, Nevada, Sacramento, and San Mateo counties. Nevada County voters are taking to this really well because, as of this morning, the Nevada County Election Office has already received 22,548 ballots. That is noticeably more returned ballots for this all vote-by-mail election than in the June primary. That's
wow.
The June primary election night, the first result was only 14,000 ballots. So there's a noticeable uptick, and probably sparked by two of the races, the first one being we have three open seats for the Nevada Irrigation District, NID. One seat is uncontested, and the two others, the candidates distinguished themselves by their position on the proposed project, which is the Centennial Dam. So this is kind of a referendum on the district, the water district's plan to maybe build another reservoir on the Bear River. The second race is a countywide race for sheriff. Three candidates in the primary, and the two that are facing off now are both currently... One is a captain, Shannon Moon. She is a captain with the Nevada County Sheriff's Office. And Bill Smothers, he is a lieutenant with the Nevada County Sheriff's Office. That race is drawing probably the most attention. If Shannon Moon wins, she will be the first female sheriff for Nevada County.
Hmm. Is this a combined sheriff-coroner position?
Yes, which... it is sheriff-coroner and public administrator.
It's interesting. There aren't many situations where that is a combined position. We heard a lot about it because of San Joaquin County over the last year. So it is a public administrator role, correct?
It is a public administrator role, absolutely.
Okay. So, Pascal, when you're out and about, you're grabbing lunch somewhere, you're standing in the street talking to someone you know, what are they talking most about with this election?
With this election, a lot of people, either they are absolutely determined to vote, and most of them already are, like, my ballot is in the mail. And one of the biggest discussion points right now is, I am checking if my ballot was received. I'm really hoping they get it on time. Mm. So there is definitely excitement about this election. I have to say that is mostly focused on the local races. We have, of course, the national discussion is, of course, ongoing, but the local races really generate a lot of interest. All the election debates and forums were incredibly well attended. So we'll see. But with 22,000 votes already in for 69,000, it's also going to be meaningful results on election night. Because that was one of the chief complaints with the vote by mail, all vote by mail ballots in the June primary. People were like, why are we not getting results? Don't we know who won? Because several races were too close to call. But apparently this time everybody gets their ballot in, and we should be able to report on election night and have especially these two races decided on election night.
Oh, it's great to hear about that participation. I also want you to stand by so that we can talk to you Tuesday and then into Wednesday. Before I let you go, you have a new Nevada County CEO, I believe.
Yes, Nevada County. That's another first for Nevada County, the first female CEO for Nevada County, Allison Lehman. She just also designated her first female to be her assistant CEO. So Nevada's change in Nevada County, and so far so good. There was a lot of fun yesterday in Nevada County for a change at the Root Center. While they were counting votes, the elections office was all dressed up, and we have to give special kudos to the Health and Human Services Administration, because I have never walked into a county office that totally reminded me of Hogwarts.
There was a little bit of Gryffindor up there, huh?
There were a lot of Gryffindor, but I saw one or two Slytherins.
Oh, you did. Okay. Well, hey, be careful, because Halloween might be over, but it sounds like...
yeah, well, you know, magic wands abound.
There you go. All right, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks, Pascal.
Okay, see you.
That's news editor Pascal Fussholer from Ubinet.com in Nevada County. One more reporter joining us from California, Gus Thompson. He writes for the Auburn Journal. Hi, Gus. So great to have you back on Insight.
Greetings from Auburn.
How's the voter interest in this midterm election?
I think there's a lot of voter interest for a lot of reasons. Locally, nationally, and of course, state.
All right. What's the highlight in the local races?
Good question. And we've got four candidates for three positions for city council. We have Sandra Amara, who's an attorney, Christopher Kirshner, a local business person, Matt Spokley, incumbent, engineer, and Daniel Berland, who works for Cal Fire, and he's an incumbent as well. All good people.
So when they're out and about talking about issues, is it affordable housing? Is it fire protection? Is it jobs, which is similar to so many communities, Gus?
Well, I made a little list here just to give the larger Sacramento area an idea of what goes on in our city of 13,000. Of course, Placer County has 350, 360 and counting. Roads, of course. We have a 100-plus-year-old infrastructure, sewer system, et cetera. We're always working on that, it seems. Homeless issues, they're about, and perhaps not to the levels of San Francisco or Sacramento. Always the budget, people using our tax dollars wisely, have to always deal with pensions and things like that as well. Up here, more so, fire safety. We have a lot of people on the rim of the American River Canyon, and they're fearful of having a fire sweep through our area. But realistically, we haven't had a big fire in Auburn proper for more than 100 years. We had a big fire about 10 years ago that destroyed about 60 homes. So it's always there. Then we have to talk about law enforcement and business growth, trying to keep that sales tax number up in the face of pressures on brick and mortar, plus also growth along the Highway 49 corridor, where there's a little bit more room to develop larger stores.
All right. Before I let you go, I do want to mention one other story you're writing about that isn't related to elections, but does have to do with drinking water being tested for lead content. This is kind of a notice that's going out, correct?
Yes. Placer County Water Agency, under state law, has been testing the local schools. We've got 45 in the Placer Water area. 11 have been tardy in getting that water tested so far. And you wonder, well, how have things gone so far? We've had one instance where a school in Loomis had a drinking fountain with lead in it. Of course, they got rid of that pretty quickly.
All right. right. It's always a pleasure. Let's talk more after elections and on into the new year, Gus, okay?
Well, thanks, Beth, for having me on, and you stay safe and well.
Same to you. Thank you. That is Gus Thompson. He writes for the Auburn Journal in Placer County. You can find links to all the stories we talked about at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Since 1985, if news happened in the Stockton area, Michael Fitzgerald was writing about it. He first joined the Stockton Record as a general assignment reporter, later became an award-winning columnist. And as long as I've been hosting Insight, he's been an intriguing, thought-provoking guest, somebody that we always appreciate listening to, even if you, the listener, might disagree at times. Last week, though, came a surprise. Michael wrote his final column. After 33 years in the newsroom, he's retiring. We did talk him into one more trip to our studio, though. So great to have you here.
It's great. And Sacramento was kind to me today that there was no traffic. It was amazing. I breezed right through. It's a miracle. The age of miracles is not over.
The pathway was opened. Why retire now?
Well, I'm 64, and I've worked there for 33 years, and I've done well over 4,000 columns, and I just feel called to do other kinds of writing. I would like to do some personal work that I think our region needs to see done. There aren't a lot of organic voices describing the San Joaquin Valley. I mean, you don't have that problem up here in Sacramento. Sacramento has a strong brand. Everybody knows what Sacramento is, but who really understands the San Joaquin Valley? Stockton to Bakersfield, eight counties. It's got a curious invisibility, a lack of a brand. So I want to do some writing that tries to give the region a better identity.
You expressed a bit of that frustration in your final column. You wrote, I mean, come on. Sacramento recently branded itself the farm-to-fork capital. Give me a break. Sacramento's not even one of California's top 10 ag counties. We are.
Right. I actually spray-painted out the farm-to-fork capital off that water tower on my way in today. You can't read it anymore. Yeah, I don't want to take anything away from Sacramento. It's a wonderful community. It's a wonderful food culture, beer culture. I mean, what a great thing you've got going on up here. What really irks me is that Stockton's leaders have not chosen to exploit the region's assets. So a city becomes great by taking advantage of its geographical blessings. Stockton has two, the soil and the delta. And yet in our previous general plan, there was virtually nothing about either of them in there. Instead, it was all about building sprawl housing for Bay Area commuters in the hopes that Silicon Valley would follow the workforce. Well, it didn't happen then, and take a look at it now. We're at the end of an attenuated bull market. If it was going to happen, it would have happened by now, and it hasn't happened. So I think that they need to – they look at San Francisco all goo-goo-eyed, or really at San Jose, and the remarkable economic transformation that's taken place there. And they really want to carve off a piece of that. And if they can, that's great. But they're looking out at 1,000 miles of unique waterways and world-class soil that I think that's our real identity. And that's where our brand and, you know, who we really are is and should come from.
Tell me about how the region changed over that three-plus decade time period. I also have to ask you about the newspaper industry. That's changing as well, and that's happening across the country. And I don't know to what degree that played into your decision.
Well, I actually wrote out a list of the way that Stockton has changed and hasn't changed. First of all, it's changed demographically. So, and the demographic trends in Stockton are different than up here and are very interesting. For instance, I don't know if you've ever heard the term black flight. We always hear white flight.
Yeah.
Well, there is a black flight going on in the Bay Area in cities like Oakland and other communities that are where black residents are just being priced out. And many of them have moved to Stockton, increasing the black population in Stockton. But there's also actually net out migration of white people from Stockton. So in 2000, there were 115,000 white people in Stockton. In 2010, there were just 100,000. So there was a net loss, even with population growth, of 15,000 white people. And it's a second white flight. The first one, of course, famously nationally, was from the inner city to the suburbs. This is an exodus from California to other states and places like Reno, Las Vegas, and the state of Utah. And of course, there's also been a large increase in the Asian population.
Can I pause you there?
Sure.
Because some people have this conversation in terms of housing or gentrification of areas in those kinds of words. And you're talking about it truly along racial lines in a way that a lot of communities aren't as specific about.
Well, demographics is just about what color you are, how much money you make. So that's, you know, that's the demographic take. There's a cultural take. For instance, I mean, this is Halloween, and 30 years ago, it was Halloween. But now it's also, you see all these like skull-faced Katrinas walking around celebrating the wonderful Mexican holiday of Dia de los Muertos. So Stockton has changed culturally as well. Its political culture changed. 30 years ago, it was dominated by the public employee unions and the developers, and both got unsustainable, either public employee compensation or sprawl, that conduced to Stockton's bankruptcy. That changed Stockton's political culture. Stockton is now chastened into austerity, so the politics are different.
Lest somebody think that you're passing judgment in how you're reporting it, I am going to quickly refer to a column that was written by Sam Quiñones. He wrote that great columnists have a common trait. They're all newspaper reporters at heart. They're going to go talk to the neighbor, the cop, the pastor, or the taco truck owner. And he praised that what you've done as a columnist, even though you had license to opine, always license as a columnist, that you combined it with an instinct as a reporter. And boy, I've heard some backlash at times when you have been opinionated, but I think it's important to understand how much of your career you were doing what you just did a few moments ago, where is step back as the objective observer and say, here's what it was, here's what it is, here's how it's changing, and your opinion isn't in there.
No, it's not. And Stockton prefigures California as a whole. It's a classic minority-majority city. It doesn't have any group over 50%. Latinos passed whites 7 years or so ago, and that was several years before it happened in California as a whole. These are just the changes that are happening in California. I like these changes. I embrace these changes. And some of the most enriching experiences I ever had as a columnist or as a reporter was when I talked to people from different places and different cultures. The different cultural perspectives that I heard enriched me immeasurably. And those broader horizons stay with you through life. So I was very fortunate to talk to Vietnamese, Khmer or Cambodian, if you prefer, Lao, as well as second or third generation Japanese, Chinese immigrants, Sikh. They're all in Stockton and more. And that's the part that where I felt I really learned something, you know, that you just wouldn't get in a seminar somewhere. The stories of human immigration and struggle, of the courage of refugees and their amazing adaptation to a new land and a tumultuous city's ability to absorb them and to benefit from them and in this great ongoing argument that's America.
Is that more of the writing that you'll be doing? Are you focusing next on people's stories?
Well, of course, all writing is about people's stories.
All good writing
is. I just feel that for whatever reason, the San Joaquin Valley keeps ending up on California's cutting room floor. And I would like to be an exception to that and to better represent our region.
You're listening to Michael Fitzgerald, newly retired from the Stockton Record. There is an archive of his columns. Is it all 4,200 plus?
I hope not. That would be an act of masochism.
Anyway, we'll post the link. And I reached under my desk and found the one book, the pamphlet that you did write from a few years ago. Really a map of Stockton's government, subtitled How It Works and How to Make It Work for You. And I think you were so civic-minded that you're probably one of those people that has expectations in retirement. How about job offers? Has that happened?
Yeah, surprisingly, I have been approached by a couple of publications and even a Sacramento television station, as well as activist groups that would like me to be involved. So I can only see the contours of retirement. I will figure out how much time what I want to do is going to take, and then with the time that I have left over, I'll do whatever I can for the community.
Any personal gap right now? Any travel or breathing room? Anything you're affording yourself?
No. I was talking with the Iowa Writers Workshop yesterday and would like to get right on it. I don't want to waste any time. That's too precious. Although, you know, I'll always make time to goof off. I always did. That's how I feel that you can make it over the long run, is that you have to balance, you know, intense work with some quiet time and time off.
Hmm. Well, from your final column, you wrote, "Some people say Stocktonians are negative. Yeah, we have an attitude. But under the jaded surface, the powerful upward reach of 300,000 people is the seed of the coming city." You add, "It was my privilege to splash a few drops of water on that seed, and I'll be here watching it grow."
Right. If Stocktonians have a common denominator, it's that they want Stockton to be better. They want it to be safer. They want it to be a more vibrant urban experience. They want downtown fixed. They want the police to be fairer. You name it. There's a yearning for transformation. And I think that it's inevitable, given the powerful undercurrent of that yearning in Stockton, that that transformation ultimately will occur.
Your voice has been important on this program.
And I so appreciate your giving me the chance to talk with you, and I've really enjoyed our talks over the years.
Yeah, I have appreciated the relationship, the input, the as I said, thought-provoking quality that you added. So let's say we'll do this again. Retirement doesn't mean you retired from Insight.
We'll see you down the road.
All right. That is Michael Fitzgerald. We'll post links to his work, including his last column, at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Courtney Hameister had one of those great jobs in radio. For 12 years, she was the head writer and host of Live Wire. It's a syndicated public radio program recorded before a live audience in Portland, Oregon. However, a few significant events, including a two-day anxiety attack, stopped her in 2013. Now she's written her first book. She will talk to the Bee Book Club in Sacramento tonight at 6. That's at the Downtown Library Galleria, and she's in the studio with me. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How is it to hear that summary of what your life has been and the turn that you took?
I mean, I think that it's so interesting. Once you write a book about it, you know, it's just like, I think that it's great because it forces you to look at your life like a scientist. And that really helps give you a little bit of perspective on it. So, I mean, it definitely, you know, it's, I've gone over the story so many times. And when I do readings now, you know, I kind of give that summary to people to kind of let them know, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote the book is because I lost this wonderful thing and I didn't want to lose something like that again. So that's kind of why I started to go on this adventure.
So fill in some of the story, which includes having your gallbladder removed, right?
Well, that was part of the reason that I stepped down as host, because a few months prior, I had had I'd had a massive gallbladder attack, and they'd taken it out. And the doctor said, well, a lot of times stress can really be a part of this. And I thought, you know, your body has only so many expendable organs until you start losing important ones. And so that was really part of my part of the reason that I stepped down, because I knew that it was so horrible for me. It was a show that we recorded every 2 weeks. And for the entire week prior, I had what I called my dread ball in my chest, you know, and it would just grow and grow and grow until Saturday. I was inside of the dread ball. It was like a big hamster ball that I was seeing the world, the muted world, through this fuzzy plastic, you know.
And yet you were really good at it and you loved doing it, right?
Well, it was, I mean, you can probably relate to this. What an honor to be able to talk to people who are so smart. You know, I got to interview Pulitzer Prize winners and Oscar winners and, you know, Gus Van Sant and Carrie Brownstein and Mike Birbiglia and Cheryl Strayed, these people who were, you know, in some ways my idols. And I got to ask them how they did what they did. That is extraordinary. And I was so lucky. And, you know, I've said it before, but when everybody thinks you're lucky, it takes a lot longer to realize how miserable you are, you know? So
the piece that we haven't really talked about here is the anxiety. Mm-hmm. And I've seen you call yourself a professional nervous person. And it is hard to pull back enough of the curtain and say it in a way that's serious enough where there's empathy for the understanding about how gripping and kind of closing anxiety can be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it depends. You know, I have both generalized anxiety and OCD, I have the intrusive thought version of OCD, which just means that you ruminate on different things. Some people have, you know, harm OCD where they're afraid they're going to hurt someone. All of these, you know, so I was kind of struggling with both of these things. And what anxiety does to you, is that it distances, as I said, it distances you from your experience. You're physically, I mean, imagine if you just always had, if your chest always felt tight, and what that does to you in terms of how you respond to people. It's very, I think we take in the world so much with our breath. And when you're an anxious person, your breathing is very shallow. So you're sort of not taking things in. You're not fully able to kind of take in ideas, and you're not really fully able to sit with people, because your brain is elsewhere all the time. And as a radio host, as you well know, you're not just sitting chatting with someone. You have a whole list of questions you're trying to get through. You're trying to tell a story. At the same time, you have producers in your ear telling you how much time you have left. You have to be thinking on all these different levels. And when your neurons aren't firing as they should be, you're screwed. Can I say screwed?
You just did. I don't think we put you on 7-second delay either.
You're not doing well, I should say. Yeah.
You're listening to Courtney Hameister. If you'd like to listen to more, she is at the Bee Book Club tonight at 6 at the Downtown Library, but I'm not done here yet. The book is titled, Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things.
Yes.
The chapters are some of your adventures in trying to get what? Closer to yourself? Could I describe it that way?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what happens when you've been anxious your whole life is that it turns you into a pessimist, because your brain has been telling you your whole life that things aren't going to work out. And diagnosed with generalized anxiety until I was in my 40s. And it was a revelation for me, because I thought, oh, this isn't my nature to be pessimistic. It's my pathology. So what if I could do things and maybe go out and teach my brain like you would a baby? Like, here are the things that are in the world to make your life interesting, and here are the things that are in the world to hurt you. Can I retrain my brain? And maybe, you know, I think that I maybe thought I could be an optimist, but I think that was a little optimistic. So, but I think that maybe looking at the world and not expecting the worst, because it changes your experience of the world, of course, right? I mean, that was part of the reason that I couldn't to host a show in front of 400 people twice a week. You have to have this, you have to sort of be great at self-delusion, you know? I mean, because it's a strange thing to do to get up in front of that many people. And sort of your self-worth is based on the opinions of 400 drunk people. That's a little, that's not,
you're
that's
talking
not a
about
great
your live
idea.
Audience. Yeah.
Exactly. We had a live audience.
So then the next question is, when you stepped down and stepped away from doing the show, how much did your life and your anxiety level change?
Significantly. And I mean, and I think that that was why I sort of had the brain space to think about doing something like this. Where so I thought, okay, I'm going to start thinking about the things that I could do that make me a little uncomfortable to think about, and those are the things that might be where I might be able to teach my brain. And so, you know, it was things like I went to a sensory deprivation tank because I'm claustrophobic and I'm not a big fan of the dark either. And I went to a professional cuddler because I don't like to talk to strangers. So I thought, well, if I'm forced to cuddle with one, that will certainly, you know, be a lesson for my brain.
I have to pause you for a moment. I heard an interesting moment when you were explaining to Mike Fitzgerald in the green room mm-hmm. about there being a professional cuddler,
yes.
that is a job that exists,
yes.
and what that experience was, which for you was extremely nerve-wracking, as
yes.
you write in the book.
Yes. I mean, well, and I think that it would be nerve-wracking for a lot of people, you know, and there are people who, you know, I think that I'm sure that there are people who are listening who think it sounds ridiculous. But I, as I wrote in the book, I felt extremely vulnerable going to her because her name is Samantha Hess, and she was an extremely successful professional cuddler in Portland. And when she got a lot of attention, this tidal wave of snark came toward her, right? Mm. And people were saying terrible things. I mean, comments like, I can't believe that people would have to pay to be cuddled. That's pathetic. Mm. And the reason why it was hard for me and I had a lot of vulnerability around going to her is that I related to the people who went to her because I have been single for the majority of my adult life. And the way that not being touched affects your brain and affects your self-worth is huge. You start to feel like you don't deserve love or you don't deserve affection. And so I get it. I understood why people, you know, went to her. And that just made me feel like I was one of those people that people were snarking at. So yeah, but it ended up being a truly lovely and illuminating experience.
Isn't
to go to
it
her.
Interesting as an adult to realize there are things that you deal with and cope with that maybe were always there that you can't unwire out of yourself? You can learn strategies for them, but you couldn't have removed, I don't think, the fact that that radio show was always going to make you anxious on
yeah.
some level.
Yeah, I think that because there are people who said, well, now you've done this thing and you know, you've really started to try to deal with your anxiety. Why don't you do it again? And I know that that will never be the job for me ever again. And that is, you know, I when I lost that show, I mourned it. I absolutely mourned that job because it was an amazing job. But you can figure out a different way to do that. What were the things that I loved about that job and how can I find them somewhere else? I can always find a way to talk to interesting, fascinating people and find out how they do what they do. You know, that's so I can write a column about that, you know. So I think that there are these things when we have this path that we're on and there's these wonderful things about it. It's about taking it apart and figuring out, because there are parts that I'm sure of everyone's job that they hate and parts that they love. So look at the parts that you love and try to figure out a path where you can still hold on to those.
You were fun and talented and funny as a radio host, but I think now through watching some of your videos, including a commencement speech that you did that was really funny, and your book, I have a sense of you as a person that I feel would be interesting to explore for the rest of your life. You know, it's not just the run of the show now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's that thing, and I think that you and Mike were sort of talking about that. You know, he's retiring, and he's done this amazing thing and written all of these columns for the majority of his adult life, and so. And we define ourselves in this country so much by what we do for a living. And so suddenly you think about making that shift and you wonder who you are, right? I mean, that was what scared me the most about leaving that show was I thought it was the most interesting thing about me. So what do I have to recommend me after that's gone, you know? But that's what you learn when you take the leap is that the world, the world sort of opens up. Or at least your world opens up, this huge space opens up, and you know how to fill that space, you know, and largely because you have to, right? Like, I have to figure out a way to make money. I have to figure out a way to move through the world. So your brain, thankfully, helps you to do that, you know, and hopefully, I mean, the thing that I tell a lot of people as I'm touring, you know, the most help I got was from someone who helped teach me mindfulness. And so getting guidance, I think, and it is huge, especially for people who struggle with any mental illness, is having someone to talk to about this stuff and process it.
There's a lot of hilarity and truth and science in this book. It is, again, Okay, Fine, Whatever by Courtney Hallmeister. And if you'd like more of the experience of the real Courtney in person, it's tonight at the B Book Club at 6 o'clock at the downtown Sacramento Library Galleria. We'll post a link online. I'm so glad we were able to have you here in studio and that we had a chance to meet. And
yeah, it was such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
When you pass through, come back in again. The mic is open.
Wonderful. I'm happy to.
Thank you, Courtney.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. November 1st sounds like winter already, doesn't it? But even if it isn't officially on the calendar, we're going to finish the hour with CAP Radio arts reporter Jeff Hudson and a preview of upcoming classical concerts this winter. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning.
Good day.
Yeah,
you made it through Halloween, right?
Absolutely.
Impersonating Hagrid, I hear.
Yes, at SciTech Academy in Knight's Landing, which is where my wife teaches.
That's the spirit. All right, let's start with a concert Friday night.
There was a good segment you did on Insight on Tuesday about the Mexican celebration known as Dia de los Muertos, or the Day of the Dead. And you can still hear that on our website. But on Friday night at the Harris Center, Ballet Folklorico de Sacramento will dance their Dia de los Muertos program. It's up on the Folsom Lake College campus, and there will be lots of colorful costumes and traditional folklorico dancing, in addition to some lively music like this. And while we are on the topic of Mexican culture, the Camellia Symphony Orchestra is doing a program of Latin American music on Saturday, I think, at McClatchy High School Auditorium, conducted by Christian Baldini, who grew up in Argentina, so he knows a few things about Latin American music. On the program will be the Sinfonia India, written in the 1930s by Mexican composer Carlos Chavez, which has brief solos for indigenous Mexican instruments. Let's hear just a little of that. This is a piece that Chavez wrote for his first American tour as a conductor, and it was premiered by the Boston Symphony. Much later in the 1970s, Carlos Chavez worked on the California coast as the music director of the Cabrillo Festival in Santa Cruz.
So again, Friday night at the Harris Center is Ballet Folklorica, and then Saturday in the McClatchy High School Auditorium is the Camellia Symphony.
Correct.
All right. There's another weekend event, though. This is concerts both Saturday and Sunday.
Right. Violinist Rachel Barton Pine has a familiar face around this area.
Yeah.
She's been at the Mondavi Center two or three times. She's been a soloist with the Sac Philharmonic. She's even done a fundraiser with the Davis High School Baroque Ensemble. She's appearing with the Reno Philharmonic on those two nights, third and fourth, performing the Brook Violin Concerto, which is a flashy, big, romantic thing. She did this recording several years ago with City Music Cleveland.
She is captivating to watch in person, and this is a violinist who plays heavy metal, too.
Right. She does have a metal band that performs from time to time.
So again, Saturday and Sunday at Pioneer Center.
Right, up in Reno. Coming up in Modesto will be the Modesto Symphony Orchestra and the Modesto Symphony Chorus. Now, the big piece on the program is Holst the Planets, which I think everybody knows. We certainly play highlights of it all the time on Capital Public Radio. But the program also includes a trombone concerto. And how often do you get to hear a trombone concerto? It's by a French composer, Henri Tomasi, from the 1950s. And it's an interesting piece. Here's a recording by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra with trombonist Jorgen von Riehen.
The trombone.
And I should mention that, as fate would have it, the Stockton Symphony also has a trombone soloist coming right up. Chris Brubeck, who's been a guest on this program, I believe.
Right.
And has been with the Stockton Symphony several times. He'll be performing a piece called The Blues and Beyond or something that he wrote for a Dutch orchestra about 10 years ago, something like that. And that concert with the Stockton Symphony will be on November the 10th. So you have two opportunities in the next week or so to hear a trombone soloist with orchestra. Very rare opportunity.
November 9th and the 10th at the Gallo Center is the Modesto Symphony Orchestra.
Right.
And then on the 10th is the Stockton Symphony.
Right. Then coming up in early December, the Alexander String Quartet is in their 16th year as a featured quartet at the Mondavi Center. They're doing the Shostakovich String Quartets, all 15 of them, in a two-year cycle. So they're going to be doing the third and fourth quartets. Shostakovich is very angular, dark, desperate music, and let's hear a little bit of this.
Alexander String Quartet, very popular.
Right.
They are the right group to take on this music.
Right, and this is music that he wrote right after the siege of St. Petersburg during World War II, when like a million people died. It was really, he saw some dreadful things.
So, Jeff, we're going to finish with a little bit of news from the music community, from Davis. We need to do a little remembrance here.
Well, the music scene lost a really significant friend this past week when UC Davis geology professor emeritus Eldridge Moore died in a fire in Quincy, where he was attending a conference in the geology conference in the field. Eldridge Moores was really prominent in academic circles. He had a lot to do with the development of the theory of continental drift and how the Pacific Plate crashing into the North American continent was pushing up the Sierra Nevada. He was in the thick of all of that stuff. In addition, if there had been a Nobel Prize for geology, he would have won it. No question about it. Eldridge also was a musician. He played cello in the UC Davis Symphony Orchestra for quite a few years. And in fact, my son played alongside him as a stand partner for a couple of years. And so he frequently attended Mondavi concerts, sometimes on stage, sometimes as a member of the audience. Let's go out with a little bit of cello music by Luigi Boccherini, part of the cello concerto in B-flat major.
Cap Radio's arts and theater critic Jeff Hudson. Again, that remembrance of UC Davis geology professor Eldridge Moores and what a tragedy that was that motel fire.
And he was one of the people who was there at the Mondavi Center on opening night in October 2002 and attended concerts regularly there. I used to see him all the time.
Hmm. There's a great place for his memory and his name in the city of Davis.
If you want to read about him, there's a really nice book by John McPhee called Assembling California. It came out in 1993, and it's basically about Eldridge.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Jeff Hudson again, and you can find more at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our producers are Jen Picard, Cody Drabble, and Bert Johnson. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today is Anthony Van Hook. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us. Happy November.